This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just the light in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host, the man who's too good to stop for a roadkill deer to check it out, Mitchell Shirk.
What's up, you knuckleheads, wing dings, and a couple of people with screws loose? Man, you'd have to be if you're going to continue to listen to the show. Welcome back. I thank you for coming on to the show and listening to what we have this week. You got to have a couple screws loose if you are into the things we're into in the world of deer hunting and turkeys and small game and whatever we're talking about here. And this week's no different. This week we're talking about something I really have put on the back burner in my life lately, and it's just because there's so much noise going on, and it's truthfully one of the things that motivated me to continue doing this podcast when it first started. And that's my passion for habitat, my passion for integrating habitat with hunting and taking plant and animal interactions to the next level, and then coupling that with your hunting and your hunting strategy. It's truthfully been the thing that I've enjoyed the most when it comes to my hunting journey. There's a lot of things about hunting I like, but that's really always been towards the top. And I put it on the back burner for things of just noise. And some of it's good noise, some of it's not good noise, some of it's unnecessary noise I inflict on myself. Like, for instance, finishing a basement. I've wanted to finish my basement now for a while, and it's been a 2-year process of doing in increments, and I'm on the final stages, and I'm in the stage that I enjoy the least. And but I mean, I see daylight, I see light at the end of the tunnel, and a promising thing for something really cool. But you know, other projects and, you know, family activities and work responsibilities, a lot of that noise has just said, you know, this off season work of habitat that you do because you want to improve your hunting. It's really taken a back burner, and I don't talk about it as much, and I don't even implement it as much. And to be honest with you, there's times I feel a little bit rusty. I forget. There's things I've forgotten. There's things that I haven't been able to adapt with and learn as you go. You know, when you get in the rhythm of doing something on a routine, you build upon it, because you never learn something. It doesn't seem like in the world of plants and habitat, and I apply this in agronomy too, it's like you never completely learn something. You learn aspects of it, and then you branch off and go into a deeper level of understanding and a different angle of viewing something and learning it and applying that. And man, there's some senses that has just been almost at a halt for me with the journey I'm on in my life. And I struggled with it for a long time. I'm okay with it now. But you know, it's a breath of fresh air when I get to interact with somebody and have them, whether it's a conversation just in life in general, or get to have them on the show and talk about some of that stuff. And this week is no different. This week, it was an honor to have Dave Hoy come on the podcast, and we have a fun conversation. Dave is a physical therapist from Central Pennsylvania. He worked his whole life, family man, got a lot going on in his life, and he's worked hard and built his business up to where he's at. But he's at the point in his life where he's taking what he's passionate about, what he's interested in, and he's turning it into this passion project. And that passion project is Integrated Habitat Solutions. Now, here's one of the things I will tell you about from this episode. Do not let Dave's humility blind you that he doesn't know that much. Because Dave is a very smart individual, and I think he's taken a lot of good experiences, been able to apply them into his own hunting, and now he's transferring that into this project where he's going to share experiences and give advice to people who are hungry for that and want to know more. And Dave's very well versed in that. And this is a fun conversation. We get to have some hunting conversation. We get to talk about some experiences he's had from the side of managing habitat in some places that he hunts, talking about food plots, talking about tree management. And that tree management goes into just cutting trees and removing overstory and from a logger's perspective and early succession perspective, but also from the side of planting trees and reestablishing different trees across a landscape, and you know, growing trees out of his garage of all places. So this is a fun episode. I really enjoyed having Dave on, and I look forward to doing it hopefully again with him in the future, updating us on things he's experiencing and learning over time. And I think you guys will enjoy it too. Before we get into this episode, please check out our partners, Radix Hunting. Radix Hunting is a company that has been. They've been the first sponsor of this show ever, and it's because they share like-mindedness and a lot of the things that we value here, and they got good products, and those products relate to this. And if you're interested in learning about those products, I would encourage you to check out their blinds, tree stands, trail cameras, and all that gear, because it's gear that's affordable on my wallet, supports a company with good values, and it really helps me in the field, and I think it would help you too. Also, check out Little Mountain Outfitters. Little Mountain Outfitters is a archery shop in Richmond, Pennsylvania. And they are well-stocked from all sorts of different bow companies and all sorts of different relevant, new, fresh equipment in the world of archery and hunting and things like that. And you can have that same feeling if you can't get to Richmond, Pennsylvania. If you go to littlemountainoutfitters.com, check out their website. It's well-updated. And they have got everything you would want and more. So check them out. And if you use the code Woodsman10, Woodsman10, you'll get 10% off of your next purchase at Little Mountain Outfitters. Appreciate you guys, and I hope you have a great week. All righty. Joining us this week, Dave Hoy. Dave, thanks for coming on the podcast. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, and this is the time of year that I always struggle with podcasting. I struggle with it because it's like it's right after hunting season, and it's far away enough that like the high points are starting to get a little bit, you know, hazy in the memory, and you know, life is shifting and we're going changing through seasons. It's just a slow time there. But the thing that I think has always excited me and got me through this time of year is talking specifically about habitat and habitat manipulation, because I think that's the thing that makes me think about the next year the most. That's just been my experience. But I know you're very much into wildlife habitat and things like that. I mean, why don't you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about, you know, what you got going and everything else.
So, I'm 52 years old. I've been hunting since I'm 12, like everybody else in Pennsylvania, at least in my generation, you start at 12, not these younger guys. They have more opportunities than we did.
Yep.
Really the only archery hunted seriously, probably the last six seasons. And I kind of got into the habitat work at the same time. Live on a 10-acre piece in central Pennsylvania. And like we were speaking before we started recording, I really didn't see deer movement and turkeys and things like that around the house until I started cutting trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like everyone else, you add a food plot. But that kind of gets you the itch. And then we have a 113-acre property in Center County near State College, and we've done some work there, and we're in the middle of a timber harvest there as well. So employing some of these activities on that property as well. And then over the last year, I've been starting up a passion project, if you will, providing soft mass and hard mass trees for homeowners, including installation and food plots. And this year I'll be a Vitalized seed dealer.
Very cool. I remember, like, growing up, I've said this on the podcast a few times, like, my dad likes to hunt, but he's not as driven into it as I am and have been. But his brother is, and I connected with him, and he was a mentor to me for a very long time in my hunting career, and still is in many ways. But he was the guy that was into bow hunting, got me into bow hunting. And he was the guy that was manipulating habitat to improve archery hunting. And the thing, you know, the land that I've been hunting most of my life, I've never really hunted farms and stuff that had open country and fence rows and things like that. Like, I've mostly hunted closed canopy landscapes. And just like you, hunting got better when that landscape got broken up a little bit. Trees got cut. A dozer or some kind of equipment went in and cleared some land and made food plots and created edge habitat and things like that. And I really grasped hold of food plots and soil, and specifically plant-animal interactions. I fell in love with that. Food plots were the foundation that trickled into early succession habitat. And like, food plots have been a niche of mine, and that's probably why I'm now in agriculture. So when you think about going into archery hunting and starting to like get into the whole world of habitat and the sea that is, do you find yourself gravitating towards one thing over another as far as what interests you the most within habitat?
I mean, probably like a lot of guys, food plotting is... It's enjoyable. It's gratifying because it's a quick turnaround for the most part. Now yeah. We see, you know, year over year change. Like at my house, it was like rocky, clay, you know, high CEC soil. So been doing things to improve the quality of that soil. And subsequently, my food plots have grown. But like the food plot, my main food plot at the house has gotten tremendously better when I started doing edge feathering. When I started to build soft edges into the plot. So it's not just a rectangle anymore. Now it's like a serpentine shape with, you know, some native grasses growing on the edges, pollinator mix into that, conifer trees into that. So I guess from the standpoint of aesthetics, it's very, very gratifying to look at. But then, you know, we started edge feathering that plot. Well, we did a nice sized timber harvest with a crop tree release. And that's probably what's made the best improvement in our hunting on this property. So I don't know if I could say one is preferred to the other for me. Yeah. Because they've all been successful, and the hunting's only gotten better on this property.
And that makes sense to me. And I like the whole system, right? I mean, everything about it from top to bottom, left to right. I love everything about making good habitat and then having it relate to a hunt. I would say I've probably invested myself into learning the most about food plots, herbicides, fertilizers, soil health, plant species, and plant biology. Like, that's been something that I've invested the most time. And I would say, like, for me, one of the things that I've got a decent level of knowledge about, but I'm not the expert in, is I'm not the expert at trees. I mean, I can identify trees. I understand the difference between a black oak and a white oak and a red oak and a black oak are in the same family, but there's differences in the different tree species. But when it starts to get into the nitty gritty of thinking about how you balance timber and how you balance that with wildlife and, even when it gets into tree plantings and like making successful tree plantings, like there's so much information out there about nurseries and tree plantings and starting your own hard mass grove or soft mass grove. And like, that's an area that like I would figure out, but the more I would do something, like I would learn some things the hard way, not thinking about, watch outs and stuff like that. I guess it's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah. That's something. I mean, there's a lot of things I have to learn, but like timber harvesting, I've noticed even like on our camp property, I walked it with a few different loggers, but I had a forester on it first, and it's a forester that cuts as well. It's just not geographically accessible for him, to bring equipment in. But I learned so much walking through the woods with him, and things you wouldn't think about. Like, so if you're doing a timber harvest in terms of economics versus a timber harvest in regards to wildlife management or long-term forestry, instead of taking the premier tree, we're going to leave the premier tree and it's going to produce acorns, if you will, or it's going to produce whatever, that's going to help us in a wildlife sense. But if I'm looking at an economic sense, I'm going to come in and I'm going to harvest that tree and take the money and maybe leave the lesser species. So that high grading is something that I think that people maybe fall into that trap sometimes. Like the current harvest that we're doing at our camp property, we're not really receiving a great deal of money from it, but it's going to improve our property tremendously. We're opening the forest up. We're getting like that disturbance. Like you said, we're going to create edge. And if it's allowed us to expand our food plots, it's allowed us to build a nice little 3/4 acre pond. So in that sense, it's a massive win.
Oh, 100%. It's very unique when you talk about timber harvest, and everybody's got their own goals. They've got their own financial situation that I think lands them in whatever pickle they're in from the side of timber. I remember a couple years ago, I had a farmer that I was working with that was talking about his farm, and he's a grain farmer, but he's got some interest in hunting in his own personal farm. They like to try to do things for hunting. And in his mind was cut the trees, make it thick, and I take what I need for the timber value and hunt. And he was talking to me when he was going through the list of people who would log it. And the first guy that came in said that there wasn't, his words to me were, oh, there's not a lot here. And quoted him, I forget what it was, what he quoted him in the number of trees. Then he had a second guy come in and gave him a much higher number with a higher, tree harvest. And he's like, I just don't understand how there can be such difference. And, at that point, my mind was thinking the difference is economics versus, long-term wildlife habitat, right? I mean, it's got to be the difference between high grading and thinking, well, you might have a 16-inch diameter breast height on this tree, but if you let it go 10 more years and you cut some of these trees around it, that might be a significantly more profitable tree. And, maybe if we let this go a little bit longer or cut it lighter, it's going to be dual benefit for what you want to do. I just think its philosophy is interesting and always comes down to the way it gets communicated, if that makes sense.
Yes. And that we were kind of in that same boat on that harvest as well. And even like the harvest at my house, in a smaller chunk of property, and there's a few 10, 15, 20, 30 acre pieces in a row that they cut. Like on our property, there was very little, but I was satisfied because I traded, some skidder and dozer work in exchange for the trees that were removed. So it allowed me to do things that I wouldn't be able to do myself. So financially, it wasn't great, but long-term success on this property was fantastic.
Very cool. So you talked about cutting trees and changing the height of the canopy across some of these properties. You've noticed has been a big change in your hunting. What's other things that you've gone in this journey of bow hunting and habitat that you've really, really picked up on and continue to learn about?
Well, I mean, a lot of things, thankfully, and hopefully we learn every day. I consume a great deal of content. I don't really listen to the radio. So like my trip to and from work is podcasts, generally, or walking the dogs, things like that. But like if I use, our property, it's not even, like you said, the food plotting. I manipulated the shape of the food plot to make it more huntable because, a rifle shot is far different than a bow shot. And my father's 81, and I wanted to allow him to have some hunting opportunity yet because doesn't get around as well as he used to. So then it's setting up hunting blinds that have appropriate screening to allow him to sneak in and out without being detected, and wind shifts and thermals and all those small things that I think add up massively. And my father didn't harvest a buck this year, but he filled all his antlerless tags at my house. And we did it in a manner that made sense. We were careful about how we did it. And I don't think it ruined the hunting because after he harvested three doe out of pretty much the same area, I harvested a very nice buck. So that made me feel successful, that the strategy is appropriate. But even like I planted some food plots for a gentleman out the road here a couple miles. And he's older as well. He's in his late 70s. And he hunts with a couple of his friends, which is, I think, is fantastic. They're all gentlemen in their 70s. They have some health issues. They can't walk as well. So we've set things up a little differently. But even like helping them learn that, sometimes the deer have to win. We have to have our hunting setups in a manner that we're not always at an advantage, but the deer's at an advantage so that they use the plot, that they use the water feature, that they use, a mock scrape or a scrape rope throughout the season. So I think it's some things like that too, just changing mindset, not even habitat manipulation, behavioral manipulation.
I think the biggest thing that I've learned over the years is the idea that the hunting season is a marathon and it's not a sprint, as was the logic that I've heard somebody use. If you go with the logic of a sprint, you're going to always put yourself what you think is the best location. No ifs, ands, or buts. And that might be at the risk or sacrifice of the wind direction, of your access, of how the thermal's going to change, yada, 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 right? And there's people that hunt that way. And I think about some of the public land hunters that are really good. I mean, they always, some of the good public land hunters I've heard, they talk about finding these low pressure spots on public land, the best spots, and being aggressive. And they go in with a logic that I'm going to go in and do it what I think is the right time before somebody else messes it up. But once I get in there, there's a good chance I'm probably not going to hunt that as much because I was pretty intrusive and I'm going to hop around to some other spots to spread my risk out. But that could be across thousands of acres. And when you're talking, what you're just talking about, it is a hard thing to learn. If you're used to hunting, the back 40 or whatever your family farm is, and we always did it a certain way. And then you take this logic of, well, instead of going to my best spot, I'm going to take the marathon approach and I'm going to be patient in the spots that I sit and be methodical in how I go. It is a learning curve. And sometimes it's actually like a hard pill to swallow when you realize like, hey, we've been doing this a certain way for a long time. And I'm realizing that I probably could have been doing it the opposite way or a different way. And it would have been better.
Yeah. I think about that. Like looking back, even like rifle hunting growing up or into my 20s and even the last few years archery hunting, you think back, boy, I remember when this buck did this but why didn't he go where I thought he was going to go? Then you think back like, I was the problem. I left ground scent, or maybe caught a thermal, or just even a change in the skyline. Maybe I was, you know, too visible, you know, as the deer approached. So, yeah, I agree with you there. And I think, you know, again, we can learn from that every time we hunt. If we look back at the end of the season and kind of summarize in our mind, what do we do well? What can I do better next year? What do I need to change for next year? Is it stand sight? Is it, do I need to be even mobile on a private piece where I'm not necessarily bouncing around a little bit, but maybe working from a less intrusive to more intrusive setup?
Absolutely. So talk to me a little bit about what you got going on with this quote-unquote passion project that you mentioned earlier in the podcast. What do you do for a living by trade, by the way?
Okay. So I'm a physical therapist by trade, and I've been doing that for the last 28 years. I'm coming up on my 29th year here in the next few months. And as I've always been involved in, my father was an excavator by trade, so grew up running equipment, landscaping, things like that. And then so that fits well with habitat work because you're planting things and cutting things and manipulating like a lawn or a yard. You're manipulating, you know, forest land, if you will. But I'd like to get into providing some of these services and materials to help other people improve their hunting and at the same time make a little extra money. But in all honesty, if it could help support my projects, I'd be thrilled. This year we're starting to provide like tree planting, assistance with food plots, which I did plant, you know, quite a few acres of food plots for people last year, both in conventional till and more no-till methods, more of the buffalo system in those no-till methods, because I don't own a no-till drill. Mm-hmm. I rent a no-till drill from an ag center and mount it, you know, to my tractor on a 3-point hitch. And then this year I'm going to be offering, or I am currently offering, some fruit trees that I've nursed along for a season or two, and they've matured nicely. And then I also have some native shrubs, red osier dogwood, nine bark. And then I'll also be getting willows this year. So I'm propagating a lot of trees. Right now I have about 600 white oaks that are in either propagation beds or containers in my basement or my garage. So there'll be a lot of 1-gallon potting, I guess, in the spring or the fall this year to winter things over. And I'm hoping next year to add a hoop house that I'd be able to even start some more cuttings like this time of the year.
Wow. So you've got mostly like a garage setup? Sorry.
Yeah, I have a garage setup with propagation beds, like air pruning beds.
Yeah.
And they're going under LED lights is all I use for grow lights. And they're not germinating as fast as the ones in my basement. But my basement's 70 degrees with radiant floor heat, so the heat's underneath, which we know is going to help with root propagation. So, and then I also have, I think, 600 chestnuts in my refrigerator that will go in air pruning beds when the weather's appropriate. So hopefully sooner than later, but I guess we'll see how the spring thaw comes.
So that, like I said, that's an area that I know enough to make myself get in trouble, but I wouldn't be able to. I would probably make some mistakes along the way. So I actually, this past year, one of the things I was doing, I was going down to New Jersey and bear hunting. You can throw bait piles out in New Jersey, and I was I'm relatively a tight wad when it comes to how much I want to spend on something like that. So I was actually going with one of those, you ever see those nut grabbers that it's like a cage and you run it around the ground?
Yeah.
Those things are awesome. And I was going and collecting acorns and throwing them in my bear bait. And I went to a wedding. One of my good friends got married, and the grove he got married at was his grandparents, and they had all these Chinese chestnut trees. I was like, well, Barry, chestnuts, can I come pick some chestnut trees? So I'm picking chestnuts up and throwing them in, and I look over to the side. I'm like, holy cow. There's two sawtooth oak trees there, and they're dropping acorns like crazy. And I went, I wonder if I grab a couple of those nuts, you know, put them in with a wet paper towel and a bag and throw them in my fridge for the winter. If they'll stratify, and I can plant them. But, you know, that's as far as I've gotten, and I'm just going to stick them and hope that some of them take. So what can I do to make that as successful as possible?
Well, the thing I've learned, and I've learned from others, obviously, just like the rest of us, and there's some people online. There's a Facebook page called Seeds to Trees, and there's people doing phenomenal things, all kind of natives. And like a white oak, you could plant in the fall, technically, if you can control the environment. So like I am controlling the environment in my basement, in my garage. White oaks don't need stratification to germinate. But like I have some Chinese chestnuts. I mean, obviously, all the chestnuts have some kind of Asian breeding into them because, you know, for blight resistance. No, they need to be stratified. So like, and that's interesting because if they're too moist, they start to mold and then you have to clean them. And I won't even tell you how many chestnuts I've washed and dried to get the mold off of. My wife is not terribly impressed when I'm doing that in the kitchen sink or like in the laundry sink. I think I have it figured out now. So I had success last year, and this year I've gone to a much larger level. Cause I probably have, I'd have to look at my sheep. I think I have like 60 chestnuts in my nursery area now that were propagated in the year past that are wintered in. So we've had a colder winter than usual in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful. I'm praying that the majority of them did survive.
When do you think you'll start planting a lot of those trees that you've got? Do you get to a certain soil temperature and you say, let's send it? Or what do you think you're going to go for this spring when you start pulling the trigger?
When the air pruning beds for the chestnuts that will come out of the refrigeration, I'm going to look for like that 55 degree weather. So I'm thinking here, April-ish. And then, like I said, the stuff that I have in the nursery that's all wintered in, and they're buried in wood chips. Once the ground's thawed, you know, I do have two jobs where we'll be installing some of those trees into someone's habitat project. And then my camp project, as the areas of timber harvest are complete, he's doing it in sections. I'm going to come in and do a pretty hard grove of chestnuts, like 15 to 20 trees, like in a 1 acre area.
Very cool. And, you know, a lot of the time I think I've thought about taking those 1 acre chunks or half acre here and there, and I'm always thinking green, lush food plots. I mean, that's just where my mind goes to.
All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
But I've been on a couple properties where people took the time to make groves of nut trees, and they're a long-term investment. But man, what a cool dynamic or a cool use of the landscape by wildlife for a portion of the season. And it's usually a little bit different than your lush green food plot, and it's just providing a different food source. And I've kind of wrinkled my nose early on, but I tell you what, as I look at the property that I have here that I live at, which is small, it's the opposite of what I've grown up with. It's got a lot of sunshine. It's got a lot of early succession, and it doesn't really have nut trees, and it doesn't have something that, you know, creates a focal point of attraction other than a food plot. So I've really thought about how can I change that, and that's kind of where I'm at with that. So I find it very interesting, and appreciate your interest and your focus on putting more trees on the landscape.
Like at, you know, my house property, if we're talking about like this one, you know, like yours, I hunt on the inside of the food plot, if you will. Like I never cross my food plot to hunt. I never want ground scent across there. I don't want my scent across there. And I do hunt like that fringe of wind, but I hunt it in an enclosed box blind. And I know that's not everyone's cup of tea, but there's no other way for me to do it. But on the far side of that, in what was cut hard in timber, I'm going to add more chestnuts and white oaks this spring. And again, I'll never be able to shoot that as an archery shot, and probably not as a rifle shot soon either, because it is starting to thicken up nicely. But again, it's like that. Sometimes the deer have to win, and it can't just be about the hunting opportunity. I think we're looking short-sighted, and we're going to have a long-term loss instead of that long-term gain. And face it, you know, I'm a bit older than you. My day is going to come when I'm no longer on this earth. And I think it's a really cool legacy to leave behind, that I did something to improve at least my chunk that I can control.
It absolutely does. How often do we make decisions with nearsighted things in life, and the repercussions of that 10, 20, 30 years later are very prolific? I mean, that happens a lot.
But, you know, even like we were talking about timber harvest. So like our camp property in Center County, that was cut as a timber harvest in the 90s. And I wasn't involved. I wasn't active in the camp at that time. I was finishing my master's degree. And, you know, as any group, we have members and, you know, we don't agree on everything. Some people think it was the best thing ever. And financially, it was great for our camp. We could do things now that we could never do before. We are always very, very tight on money. But I look at some of the long-term repercussions. We have a terrible invasive issue with Japanese barberry.
Mm.
We have Tree of Heaven. That's a lot more than I'd like to think about. And we have a bad balance of trees. Like, we have a lot of soft mass trees that are not healthy. We have a lot of conifers. We have like 20, 22, 24 inch DBH hemlocks. So I'm hoping with this harvest, and this is my project, so I'm proud of it. I think it's going to reset the landscape and allow us to get back into balance, but it's going to take us a lot of work that maybe if our timber harvest was done differently back in the 1990s, we won't be battling these things now.
Oh, that's a great point, Dave, because I think about timber harvest that I've seen over time, and, you know, the concept of what was trying to be done of, you know, cutting trees, creating sunlight and all that stuff, that it moved the needle that direction. But there were things from that, for instance, you know, just cleaning up a little bit the mess that the skidder made. Like, sometimes it was too big of a mess. Sometimes it damaged soil and left big ruts, and that just kind of affected, you know, the surrounding landscape. Or sometimes the treetops and the trees were cut so thick that it actually worsened. It made the habitat worse because it was just a jumbled up mess rather than maybe a little bit of strategy behind it. Not dealing with invasives at early hand. And it all comes down to so many timber harvests. They're done with the logic of, well, I'm going to cut this. This is going to make my hunting better. And we don't have to do anything anymore. It's done. And habitat management and manipulation never, ever comes to an end. It never finishes. I remember listening to Grant Woods when he sold the Proving Grounds. And I heard him say that I felt like I'd done as much as I could to changing that habitat. Like, he said something along the lines of he felt like he was capped out of taking that property as far as he could go. But that didn't mean there wasn't work to maintain that. It was a lot of work to maintain that. And I don't think we ever get away from that.
Now, I had a conversation, and I have a phone call with a gentleman tomorrow night from Southern New York that we're going to help, like I said, the execution of some of his work. And I said to him, I said, please remember, like, again, it's not a sprint. You're not going to get this all done in 1 year. And even when you get to whatever you think your goal is, it takes work to maintain it. You know, we're talking about things like understory of ferns. It's very hard to get any germination of new trees or undergrowth with ferns, so you may have to spray. And, you know, then, you know, you talk about protecting, you know, say oak trees that are germinating or whatever. We have to protect them. So I said, well, we can tree tube those and then spray around it, and the tree tube will protect that seedling. So just things like that I don't think people are aware of, they don't think about, unless they learn the hard way, which is how I learned.
Well, a lot of us learn the hard way. I'm still learning the hard way in a lot of stuff. Like planting a tree, I planted some persimmon trees one time just around my food plot, right? And I thought this was going to be the greatest thing, and realized over time that, number one, I didn't do a good job of protecting them. So I think I planted four, and I'm down to one. So I need to plant another one because, you know, persimmon trees need at least two, I think, in order to fertilize right. and create tree fruit. So I've got one persimmon tree, and it's not going to do anything. So I need to fix that. But, you know, there's things about the setup in that landscape that I've realized I need to change. I need to change location and how deer move through a food plot. I need to cut some more overstory trees that I overlooked. Well, that makes it a pain in the neck when you've got a delicate tree you've been babying for the last 5 years trying to get it to go some. Now you got a tree that, if I'm not careful, I'm gonna kill this seedling tree that I want because I have to drop these trees and work equipment around it, and it's gonna disturb the soil. And like having a process and a plan in place is very important, and that's a challenge.
Yeah, it's like we talked about earlier. You know, the best time to plant a tree is yesterday. We've all heard that, or 10 years prior to that. But if you didn't do the heavy lifting first. You know, even like if you're like a bedding cut, like you'd want to go in and do your crop tree release or whatever your goal is in your large cut. And you kind of come in and fine tune that cutting into trails or, you know, gentlemen that cut in like bedroom style in that bedding. So I guess it's the, you know, the big swath first and then the delicate work later so that we don't ruin fruit trees, that we don't ruin newly, you know, freshly germinated trees. Like I don't want to be dropping trees into my food plots either. Because I don't want to bring heavy equipment in there and cause compaction. Like, especially here at my house, my soil here is much heavier than, like, my camp property. So there I'm not as concerned about it. Up here, the last thing I want to do is take anything heavy across that plot.
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing more frustrating than getting a food plot to something the way you want it. And then once you have it, you decide you're going to do a timber harvest, and the only access to a section of the timber harvest is for this giant heavy piece of machinery to drive across your food plot and create an absolute mess, dragging trees and compacting soil and just making an absolute mess of things. Like, that's something to really keep in mind when you're thinking this. Like, I gravitate towards food plots, right? But having a process or a plan in place of building the foundation and going from there, I think is pretty critical. And that's where it helps to talk with people who, you know, have experience and have made those mistakes, and you can learn from them. Like, well, this is actually your lowest hole.
Yeah, definitely.
So when you think moving forward, you know, you were talking about, I'm going to backtrack a little bit for a second. So you're going into your 29th year of this journey of being a physical therapist. Talk to me as a person who's, you know, worked a job and had a career, but you're at the point in your life where you want to make a shift. And I'm at a point in my life where I think all the time, I wonder what I'm going to do when I grow up. And I'm in my 30s now, so I think I'm past that point of saying, what am I going to do when I grow up, right?
Never.
Never? Well, that makes me feel a little bit better. I'm curious, like, you look at working your tail off in a professional career. I don't know how to ask this question, Dave. I'm wondering, like, your passion of hunting and habitat and things like that, like, how have you balanced it over time? Like, that's been a struggle for me in balancing passion over career and things I got to do. It's like, what's it been like for you?
Well, at your age, I was in a probably a very similar position to you, where your family should always be most important. But as your children get older, what they need from you is different. You know, like people say, you know, who's your favorite child? Your favorite child is the one that needs you the most at that time. And sometimes that favorite child might not be a child. Maybe it's your wife. Maybe it's your parents. I'm to the point now. My oldest son will graduate from college in May. My youngest son's a sophomore in college. So they don't need me in the same way as they did when they were involved in Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts and football and basketball and things. Because that was the most important thing to me at that time, is to spend time with them and to mold them to be responsible adults, and thank God they're doing fantastic. So now I have a little more time for these projects. So at your age, it's terribly difficult to try to do what I'm doing now. And I'm very fortunate that I really love what I do. I love being a physical therapist. I get paid to help people, and I like the nuts and bolts of it because it's troubleshooting. It's troubleshooting all day long. But I can also see where I'm hoping in the next few years I don't have to work as many hours as a physical therapist as I do now, and that if I had this passion project rolling, it's a nice balance of the two. I'd be working inside part of the week, and let's face it, it's nice to get outside. It's not good for us to be inside all the time. And for us to age appropriately, and I know this based on my profession, we need to move. We need to stay strong. We need to stay active. We need fresh air. We need all these things. So I just think it's a good metamorphosis. So, you know, my business name is Integrated Habitat Solutions. And the reason it's called integrated is it's an integration of my life's work. It's the things I've learned through the years, easily and the hard way. And I'd like to integrate those experiences to help others and then to move into the next phase of my life.
I'm so glad you brought that into perception, I think is the word I'm trying to say. I can't speak tonight. I'm really struggling. And the reason for that is my grandfather one time said something to me that I rolled my eyes at when I was a kid. He said something along the lines of, like, the young think they know it all and the old think they've seen it all. And I remember when I was younger, like, there was a point in my life where I really thought that my passion in habitat and wildlife and all that stuff, like, that was going to lead to a career, and I was going to make something, and I was going to do this, and I knew a lot, and I knew the most about food plots, and I was going to be able to fix people's problems and help people and create a business and blah, 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 blah. And I'm learning as I'm doing things as a consultant in the agricultural world that it's not necessarily about knowing all the technical things right. It's about all the other stuff. And you talking about integrated habitat, and it's a combination and it's a foundation of your life's work. How much do you think having the experiences and the perspective of other aspects of life, how much that's going to help build something out in this passion project versus maybe being really technically proficient but not having all the well-rounded. Am I making sense with the question I'm trying to ask?
Yeah. Well, you know, in my job as a physical therapist, and I'm technically a clinic director, so I have operated a clinic in the same town for the past 26 years. And at one point, I was overseeing multiple clinics. You learn how to problem solve not only your patients, but operational things. But you learn how to deal with people. And that can be a challenge. And sometimes it's easy to blame others, but people have an effective desire when they walk in the door. Like, they have an idea of how they want to treat their back pain or their neck pain or whatever. And it would be no different than trying to help someone with their habitat project or their land. That's their land. And I think sometimes, you know, a consultant or someone providing a service doesn't necessarily, how do I say, my idea might not match what their goals are. So I think, you know, all the years of dealing with people, I think, has helped me learn, and obviously through trial and error, because I've made plenty of mistakes in how I deal with people, you know, to be mindful of others, to be mindful of their goals, to be mindful of their position in life, where they are. So I think that's part of it, too. And like you said, in your earlier days, you know, you thought you were going to be this whitetail consultant or this, you know, habitat consultant, and you were... I think the problem with a lot of people in this space, and I'm not throwing shade at anyone, believe me, there's many, many people out there who are very, very intelligent. But when you're doing it full time, there's an amount of stress that I cannot imagine. And I don't want to be trying to provide, you know, trees or food plot seed or services to someone that they really don't need just because I know I have to make X amount to support my family. So I think this casual approach that I'm taking to it, I don't have a financial expectation. I know, like, I percentage wise what I need to make, because obviously I can't take a brand new tractor out and do a job or side by side or equipment or trees. and do it for free because that's foolish. But it takes some of that stress away, and I think I can provide for people without a bias, if you will.
It makes perfect sense to me. And I said this before, like doing anything for a living in the hunting industry and making it a full-time, financially successful ordeal, that is a rarity. And I think there's this idea that a lot of people are making buku bucks and big time in the hunting industry. I think it's false reality in what's perceived through the lens of social media and YouTube and stuff like that. I think it's a very, very small percentage. Because think about it. What percentage of our population in America is a hunting, habitat-oriented group of people? It's very small. I don't know what the number is, but it's probably less than 10% of the overall population. So now you take that
statistic that it is in the single digits.
So take a single digit percentage. Now that is your clientele that you're trying to work with. And then you've got all these people that are within it that are so passionate that it creates this high level of competition. Like, it's just very, very hard. So when I think about consulting in habitat, I learned this a long time ago in my job in agriculture. Somebody told me one time, that was when I was first starting out as a consultant, a guy that had been working in the agriculture industry for 40-some years was talking about the dynamics of the agricultural industry. And he said, Mitchell, you cannot be the expert at everything. He said, you cannot be the expert at corn disease, soybean disease, insect pressures in all those crops. You can't be the expert in corn planter and corn planter setup and drill setup. You can't be the expert in like all these things, but you can be good at certain things and build a network and ask questions and build that network to help people. And because agriculture is diverse, it makes it an opportunity for career. Think about that from the side of habitat. You know, let's just say I'm the food plot guy and Dave's the tree guy. How much business do you think that I could retain as just doing food plots and not putting the whole picture together, or Dave could do just planting trees and not putting a whole holistic plan together, right? It's hard to do that in my position as a full-time employee trying to, you know, own a business, work a business, make money, you know, raise a family, that stuff. That is almost impossible. Can it be done and is it being done? Yes. And I think the way it's being done is I think sometimes people are biting off more than they can chew and creating this I have all the answers. And I don't think very many people do have all the answers. I'm rambling now, Dave. This is just where my mind's going in this conversation.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, in my profession as a physical therapist or in doing habitat work, we need to consult others. Like in the physical therapy world, we see an increasing number of, we say, tween age, you know, 8 to 15 year old pediatric patients. And we could talk about this for 3 hours that you wouldn't find as interesting as I do. So there's some changing things where our children have become more injury prone, if you will. That's a hard population to treat. So I have a friend, he treats 0 to 3-year-olds. So when I have a kid that's closer to that 3-year-old, I call him. I say, hey, Steve, I need help. I don't want to do this kid a disservice. Can you give me some ideas? So same thing being said, if someone calls me and says, hey, like my food plots aren't doing what I want them to do. Can you help me plant them? Can you help me do some other stuff? And I don't know what to do. I'm going to pull a soil sample. And I'm going to speak to someone like you, or I'm going to speak to someone like Al Tomechko. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to get help from others, and I can't be too proud to do that. And maybe that's the wisdom thing, like your grandfather told you. An older guy like me, you realize there's so much we don't know, and I honestly don't want to do someone a disservice. I want to see, like, I planted a food plot for the gentleman down the road that I was talking about earlier. We did a couple acres last year, and something he never would have done. So we did it, you know, the way I wanted to do it. And one of his friends that hunts, that's an elderly gentleman, shot a beautiful 128, I think it was, inch buck. I was thrilled. They had success. To me, that was great. And it it definitely outweighed the couple dollars I made planning a food plot for him.
Oh, absolutely. And it's probably easier for you to enjoy that when there's not a financial burden over top of that, right? Hey, you should make a couple bucks doing something like that. I mean, you're providing a service and a business, but when your sole focus is not maximum income from something like that, I think it changes the dynamic. And I mean, money is not everything. I mean, we need to make money. We need to make a good income. I need to support my family. I need to pay my mortgage to do this. Like, that is important. But I think when we take our passion and we make it like finances or financial gain towards the top within our passion, it just gets hairy. I don't know how to dissect that, but it just gets hairy.
And again, if we talk about my profession versus this project, yes, this project's definitely the same way. Like, I don't want to talk poorly about people, but you'll see people in the industry like, I'm sponsored by X bow company this year, and mm-hmm. that's the best bow ever. And next year, I'm sponsored by a different bow company. This starts to make you scratch your head a little bit. Or like in the medical world, unfortunately, the company I work for is owned by shareholders. They want to see profit. So there's goals and expectations. That's the part of the job I don't like. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's like that in all aspects. I guess it's like everything. We need to be somewhere in the middle. I need to support my family. I'd like to retire someday, or at least not work full time. I don't need to have a brand new pickup truck. I don't need a $100,000 pickup truck. I just want a reliable pickup truck.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it's all about expectations.
So I'm curious too. Is there other things when you think about what you would like to accomplish when you talk about integrated habitat? What would you like to personally succeed or accomplish by doing that? And I'm coming at this from the angle of not necessarily just, you know, you brought up helping people, right? You want to see people succeed and, you know, hopefully not make some of the mistakes that you made in your journey of your cabin property, your home property, and maybe but I'm thinking along the lines of the personal changes within your life and that shift off of the stress and the daily life that is your personal career and the way things have been for the first half of your life.
I mean, all aspects of it, like we talked about, going to carry Vitalized Seed this year. And we can offer a very good product at a very reasonable price. So I've had a lot of phone conversations over the last few weeks. And who doesn't want to talk about food plots?
Right.
You know, so if I can move, you know, a pallet of seed and I can help some people have success and I make a couple of dollars off it, that's awesome. And again, from a business sense, if that leads to some installation of food plots or some installation of trees or just selling some people some trees, I can obviously do well with that. And like the nursery, going to have to expand my square footage this year, which is exciting. Will be a little daunting when I start potting all these trees this year. But like to me, that's enjoyable. Like even on like evenings like tonight when I work later till 7 o'clock, like last summer I come home and I just sit in my truck and look at the trees. I guess it sounds to some people it might be ludicrous, but it's satisfying. Like, hey, I started that tree from a nut. And now look at it. It's 3 foot tall and it's thriving. It's doing fantastic. Or I bought that bare root fruit tree. It was 4 foot. And now look at it. Now it's 7 foot and it's producing fruit in a 7 gallon pot. So I find that satisfying. But to me, that's a personally, I like to grow things.
You like the process.
Yes. And I think like a lot of people that get in a habitat, sometimes the process is as much fun or more fun than the hunting.
I truthfully think when you talk to people and they say something along the lines of, I enjoy the habitat work and I enjoy the process as much as I do the hunt, I think that's somebody that is on a journey at some point of saying they just enjoy the whole viewpoint of creation. And it's not just about hunting and shooting stuff. Like there's something to be said about seeing the whole process unfold and having satisfaction from like that. I remember listening to one time somebody said, I won't say his name. A lot of people know who it is because he's very prominent in the world of hunting. But he said, if you compare shooting a mature buck on a food plot versus shooting a mature buck that you've scouted for in tough terrain and tough habitat, blah, 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 and you do it that way, the level of satisfaction is greater, you know, on the hang and hunt type public land grind hunt than it is on a food plot. Well, I've done both, and I don't agree, and here's why. The deer, would I agree with that statement if it was somebody else that did all the work and I came and sat in the tree stand and shot the deer? Okay, now you got me. But when you get to be part of the whole process and benefiting wildlife, yeah, the hunt itself is easier. I mean, I might have made a groomed path to my tree stand that I can hide behind, climb up, and wait for this perfect wind, and it's within a border that is pretty well protected and it's posted and people can't go in it. Like, yeah, that hunt is easier. But that didn't mean the process was any easier. Like, if you work your tail off all season long, or preseason or off season long to get to that point, we're doing different things to get there. But like, I have not found that one is more satisfying over than another if you're doing the whole process to get there.
He's got to be one of my best friends. He's a gentleman. He's your age. He's quite a bit younger than I am. He's a hang and bang hunter, if you will. He's a saddle hunter. He goes deep on state land, and he does very well. I don't know anyone else that's getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and heading in. And he shot a nice buck this year, and I shot my personal best on this property in rifle season off groomed land, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent him a picture, and he works overnight. He's an ICU nurse, so he didn't see it till later in the day when he woke up in the afternoon. And he was like over the moon, and I almost felt guilty about it. Like, I shot this, and he's like, what are you talking about? Like, he kind of brought that same perspective into place. You know, and him and I, we talk about things like, we're trying to move the needle, and we need to be patient. Again, this habitat works. Things can be short-term. I can grow a food plot, and it may look really great the first year, depending on the soil. But when we're doing crop tree release, when we're doing, you know, hinge cutting, when we're trying to open the canopy, we're trying to manipulate God's work, if you will. And we're not, like most things in life, we're not working at the creator's speed. We're not that patient. So I think there's something to be said about that, that we're like helping that along, if you will, because we don't have natural disturbance like we did thousands of years ago. We don't let fire ravage the landscape. So there's things we can do with a chainsaw that at least closely mimic that, if not to that extent.
100%. And I definitely think there's something to be said about just enjoying the process and doing it. And I think I'm having a little bit of an epiphany here, because I have gotten myself a bit impatient in some of the settings that I've hunted. Like, I've been trying to shoot a buck with my bow at my camp on this state property, and I still haven't done it yet. To be frank, I haven't put as much time into it as I should.
Mitch, that's one of my goals as well, and I've yet to succeed at it. So it's moved from the short-term list to the long-term list.
And when I look at that thing, I've been very nearsighted and short-minded, and I haven't dove in and enjoyed the process with it. And all the while, I'm talking about enjoying the process of manipulating habitat and seeing things come together. And I'm realizing for a lot of my hunting experiences, I've been part of the process and the habitat side of things, and that's paid dividends and rewards with deer that I've shot on private land with manipulated landscapes. I've been pretty lucky and successful on public land hunting with a gun. But the bow hunting thing and the process of fine-tuning my hunt on that landscape, I've been rushing. And I'm listening to myself saying, Mitchell, this whole process thing you're talking about in private land, you haven't applied that same logic. So you helped me with something tonight, Dave. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So we've been rolling for an hour, and I want to be mindful of your time. And I think what we should probably do is continue to check in with you throughout the year and stuff with some of the projects and stuff you've been doing and learning and along the way with Integrated Habitat. So let's do that and circle back at some point. But I want to make sure before we go, can you please cue people in? Where can people reach out to you, follow along as you go on this journey and see, you know, if they listen and said, man, Dave makes a lot of sense with what he's doing and I'm interested in it and I want to talk to him more about what I got going on, you know, where can they do that?
So I have a website, integratedhabitatsolutions.com, and then a Facebook page and an Instagram page, both of the same name. And my contact info is on there. And like I said, and I'm, I don't want to say advertising, but I posted on a reel the other day, like, I am taking phone calls. Like, if I can help you, let's have a phone conversation. I'm fine with that. And, you know, let's talk for a half hour, 45 minutes. Because again, at the end of the day, who doesn't want to talk about food plots or trees?
Exactly.
or timber stand harvest? Yeah, and you get on a list. I said, I'm taking some pre-orders for Vitalized Seed products. And as you know, it's a good product with a great deal of support behind it. And then I also will have fruit trees and hard mass trees and some native shrubs available this year. And hopefully, you know, more and more years to come as I develop my nursery.
Very cool. Well, again, it was a pleasure to have you on, and I can't wait to do it again, Dave.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.